This is The Conversation. It's episode 154 with Lauren Seiden, New York-based artist. She used to work in a gallery. Now she makes art full-time. You will find out how. She also lives in Manhattan. A young artist who lives in Manhattan. It's got to be pretty rare these days, I would think. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where I highly recommend that you go to check out images of Lauren's work as well as her studios over the years, the Lower East Side, a small one in Chelsea, and her current one in Greenpoint, as well as the roof view from Greenpoint, which is quite impressive. Good thing to have in the side of your mind as you listen to our conversation. So go check those things out. Last episode, in fact, the last two episodes, 152 and 153, part one and two, were with Nato Thompson. I highly, highly recommend you have a listen to those if you haven't already. He is the head curator, artistic director, I think his official title, at Creative Time. And he is also a writer who has written Seeing Power, Art and Politics in the 21st Century. We talk a lot about some of the takeaways from that book and beyond. And he's super insightful and was super great to talk to. So I highly, highly recommend that if you haven't listened already. And I do have something before we get to the conversation that Lauren shared with me about working in galleries, which I did not ask her in our conversation. So I do want to let you know about that ahead of time. First, I wanted to ask you guys a favor. You may have heard me mention in past episodes that we are doing an ongoing survey on your tastes and interests in relation to this podcast for programming purposes, and a paltry number of people have filled out that survey. The survey can be found, by the way, at theconversationpod.com/survey. So what I'm asking is if you would be so kind as to fill it out, that would be fantastic. Or I'm opening up to a simple email or social media reply. So you can go on at Artist Podcast on Instagram, Twitter, or even Snapchat, although that might be a little tricky as far as collecting information. We're on Snapchat, by the way. Did you know that? We just joined Snapchat. I'm not manning it or anything, but we got that account going. So, and I do have somebody helping with that. So check it out if you are on it. So what I'm asking is if you would be so kind as to fill out the survey at theconversationpod.com/survey, that will help me and us on the team figure out or at least have a sense of what you prefer as far as episodes. The numbers are so small right now. Let's just say it's somewhere between 10 and 50 on the lower side of that. That, you know, I can't really go by that number of people who have responded and say, oh, okay, you guys want artists more than anything else. So all that to say that if you just shoot me an email and say, you know, I like the variety, I really prefer artists, I really prefer writers, or do that via Instagram or Twitter, that would be great. That would be really helpful because it's a conversation I had recently. You know, originally it was all artists. Some people I know prefer that. I don't. I prefer the variety, prefer talking to all kinds of people, and I prefer getting the best guests as well. So that's basically where I'm coming from. But I would love to hear where you're coming from and what you like, because one of the objectives here is to get as many listeners as possible and to hold on to the ones that we have. So do weigh in on that. It would be greatly appreciated. All right. So I asked Lauren, let me set this up, because what I asked Lauren about after we spoke, and actually very just the other day, is what her experience was working behind the desk at a gallery as far as how you respond to visitors. And this came up because for a couple of reasons, actually. One is that I was seeing a few shows with my friend Maureen Halligan, and we only saw a couple of shows, but they were in West Hollywood. I'll just leave it at that. And the vibe was not, you know, particularly inviting, as is often the case at certain types of galleries. And she mentioned that she was in New York last spring, and with the exception of one gallery, she and her fellow gallery goers got pretty much the cold shoulder, or the, you know, the cold routine. She got the lack of warmth. She got the cold routine from various galleries, all the galleries in New York that she and her group went to. And also, there was recently an interview with Stefan Simkowitz, the collector and otherwise provocateur, who mentioned a friend of his who was going into all these galleries, I think in L.A., Los Angeles, and you know, was being treated rather coldly and rudely. And it turned out this is a Silicon Valley guy with a lot of money. And so, I you know, you got to wonder what's going on a lot of times still after all these years with galleries. So I asked, all that to say that I asked Lauren, you know, what was the protocol at the galleries that you worked at, and what were you told to do, you know, being there at the desk? And this is, and I'm pretty much going to quote her fully because I think she has some really insightful things to say. She wrote, "It was expected and encouraged to be welcoming and smiley to people who visited the gallery. I started my job at 303 as a receptionist / front desk and trained others for that position after moving to the back office. It was my job to greet people with a friendly demeanor and be able to answer any questions about the show with thorough information. But if pricing was inquired, I was to get one of the other gallery staff who handles such things." She goes on, "I'm a real believer in breaking down that cold and elitist environment the galleries often have a reputation of being. That being said, I'm sure I wasn't always as friendly as I could have been, but that was only because sometimes you were being bombarded with emails and other tasks while patrons may approach the desk to take a press release. It is important to try and remember to smile and acknowledge people standing in front of you. We all appreciate that. Sometimes you go to galleries and feel like perhaps if you were dressed a certain way, you may receive different attention. And that is bullshit. Everyone should be greeted with the same respect. You never know who anyone is and should always talk to everyone with equal respect and courtesy. It's not just about sales. It's about creating an environment where people can appreciate their experience with the art on view. I would say that for the most part, if people are not greeting you as kindly as perhaps they should, it is probably because they are just super busy. I have noticed lately that many galleries have built walls up at the reception desk so you can't even see a person sitting there. On one hand, this further creates a divide and difficulty for personal interaction, but on the other hand, perhaps it alleviates that feeling of being discarded as unimportant. Again, anyone working at the gallery who is visible to the gallery goer should look up and smile. Allow that entryway for a warm and welcoming environment. I am most surprised when small galleries don't take the time to do that, as they should be building a good reputation for their new business. And like Maureen, this is something Maureen mentioned, said, it's the small things that make that one gallery stand out as a good experience, aside from the art itself. So that's, to me, that's just spot on. I think on one hand, I totally sympathize with people who are trying to get work done, and then people are coming up and it's like, you know, I'm trying to get work done, but I need to be nice to you, and I can see how that could be challenging. But I think the idea of having the big wall and just you go in and you don't see anybody, I think that actually kind of makes a lot of sense for a lot of galleries. Instead of having somebody sort of glare at you or sort of aggressively ignore you, I think just having them there where you can go find them if you really need to is probably maybe makes the most sense from my perspective. But anyway, enough about that. I hope you found that insightful, and I hope it maybe gives you an interesting color to have as you are listening to our conversation, to what Lauren has to say about other matters. And stay tuned on the back end where we do our social media shout out and we do a new series called Bad Advice. So thank you so much for being here, and let's get to that conversation now. Okay, so you're in an undisclosed location, we'll just say, but you live...
I mean, you could say I'm home, it's fine.
You're home, okay. You're home out in Long Island, yeah. but you live where in the city?
I live in the West Village.
Okay, and where's your studio?
In Greenpoint.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. So that's pretty cool. You live in Manhattan. What's that like?
It's good. I've been in my apartment for about 14 years.
Wow.
And yeah, so it was after graduating college, I kind of couch surfed for a bit and then found this apartment, and it is rent controlled, and so I have stayed there.
Yeah.
And like the neighborhood's changed a lot, but
was that like hitting the lottery even at the time?
Yeah, I mean, it was super, it's gone up in price since I first moved there, but yeah, it's a sweet deal. And my studios used to be in the city. So, I've only been commuting to Brooklyn for a few years now.
Wow. Where were your studios in the city?
My first studio was on Ludlow Street
in
2007.
Right. Okay. Uh-huh.
And now, it was like a big shared loft space.
Well, I mean, you're from the New York area, so you know the city quite well, I would imagine. I'm just going to give you my sort of rudimentary take on the East Village. I used to live in New York myself, but it's been a while. And I'm just going to say that with this majorly established gallery district of the Lower East Side as of what, the last 4 or 5 years, something like that? And then before that, when you were there, I guess, there was like an intermediary phase when, I guess, part of which when you were there, and then maybe if you go back to the 80s, maybe early 90s, it was more on the funky side.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in Manhattan, and I had never gone to the Lower East Side.
'Cause it was too dangerous.
Yeah, it was dangerous. I was young, but my dad lived in Stuyvesant Town, which like now isn't, you know, I know isn't that far from there.
You and I were neighbors. But,
oh, nice.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I lived on 77th with my mom, but went down. He lived on 18th and 2nd. But yeah, I didn't really go much further south.
Right.
And so, but like did go there kind of like more in high school and like go to some bars and go to the East Village and things like that.
I have to wonder, sorry to interject. I kind of have to wonder before I forget if your being a Manhattan / New York native has been a big factor in your being able to stay there. In other words, if you take somebody of your age coming from elsewhere in the country, you know, to New York, that they wouldn't sort of have either the savvy and or the connections, you know, to find a rent-controlled apartment?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I really did it the old-fashioned way, which was basically, well, at the time, my boyfriend who went to NYU's dad was subletting a place there in this building, and we would stay there sometimes. And my parents were like, you know, back in the day, we used to just walk around and ask the doorman if there were any available apartments.
Right.
Just ask them.
Right.
And I asked the doorman like every month if anything was opening. And like they were like, actually, there is. And, you know, kind of like probably gave them $100 and like they opened the door and showed me the apartment. So it was a bit like that. Unfortunately, the building got bought out. And there was a bunch of renovations and, I mean, the whole neighborhood has changed a bit. Like I live on 14th and 7th. So it's like, you know, one block in each direction, it's kind of like a different neighborhood.
Right.
So one block like north is Chelsea, one block, you know, west is like you just nicer West Village. And right where I was like McDonald's, Grace Papaya, Cash for Gold, things like that. But now it's, you know, Organic Market and a Chase Bank and Barney's is up the street.
Right.
So it's changed.
Are there any more Papayas or Cash for Gold in Manhattan at this point?
I think so. Not right there though.
Right.
But I'm pretty sure there are, not in that area anymore.
Right.
Though.
Right. Right.
But my block actually, you know, I'm watching it change over 14 years, and I felt like the change that even I saw, and I'm certainly not like a local to the Lower East Side. Like I would never claim to have like grown up there in the 80s or 90s.
Right.
But even just being there from, 'cause I was working down there too at some bars. And a lot of my friends worked there, and it was kind of like where like this little community, formed, especially in the studio. It was a shared studio loft.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because I wrote to a knife ad.
Mm.
And two of the girls that were in the space are now like two of my closest friends. Everybody's still making art.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of like my first kind of like art community.
Yeah, that's
part
fantastic.
Of it. No, I mean, it's like amazing. It's I feel like super fortunate.
Yeah, because when you mentioned that, when you mentioned that before we spoke, one of the things I thought about was if that's something that you think is somewhat commonplace, and obviously the answer is no. It's very lucky, and you recognize that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I think it's super lucky. It was so by chance, just because of like my own circumstance and certain things that were happening in my life. I hadn't made art in a few years, and I started to make art again in my house. And I live in, it's like a big studio, but it's like a studio apartment.
Sure.
And I just was like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to get a studio. And I saw this ad, and I met with, the girl who was putting it together, and, Ludlow between, Delancey and, does that make sense?
Delancey
and Rivington.
Delancey and Rivington. Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And yeah, I just really kept to myself and was super quiet and would go there all the time. But didn't really talk to people for probably a year in there. I just didn't have like the confidence to kind of, I don't know, like, I think I even like put a sheet up and was just really like nervous about making work again.
How many of them were you there?
Let's see, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Okay, and it was and each person had sort of a little section, but there weren't necessarily walls dividing the spaces.
Right, exactly, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Like
sounds
I couldn't
intimate.
Even imagine doing that now.
Yeah.
Or even sharing with one person without like some kind of
right.
divide. But,
sure, sure.
But it was pretty amazing, and really most people weren't there, and I went on the weekends a lot and would be there super late, and. You know, leave, and my friends all worked at bars nearby. But it was amazing. And it was there from like 2007 to 2010. And even in those few years, like that neighborhood changed.
Right.
And the galleries, because I was working at galleries in Chelsea at the time, but, the only galleries I can remember over there, and I could be just missing some cause I wasn't familiar enough with the area was, I remember like Rivington Arms and Rachel Uffner was there and on Stellar Rays.
Right.
Those are the ones that I remember like have been there for a long time. I remember passing them.
Which was the first gallery that actually set up shop there? Because that, you know, it's still not very long ago that, you know, that the first one was there. It's not like Soho.
Right. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. But they're all still really, in their same spaces that they were when they started, with the exception of Rivington Arms?
Well, Rivington Arms doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
Rachel Uffner moved to a different part of the Lower East Side.
Mm-hmm.
And On Stellar Rays recently moved.
Got it. Okay.
To a new space, yeah. Yeah.
We should talk about how you started working at galleries so early, so quick out of the gates. What was...
Mm-hmm.
Were you just an art lover growing up, and so getting into the intern game made sense like as soon as possible?
Yeah, I mean, I went to school for art, and then I went to college for art, and in my college they had like it was 2 or 3 month session called field work term.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to work or you had to intern someplace in your field of interest.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came back home and my first internship was at Karen Golden Fine Art when I was 18.
Wow.
And that was on 26th Street in like the Green Naftali building.
Right.
It was just different galleries within the building. And then, so Nicole Klagsbrunn and, I did a few days at Sean Kelly and I feel like a different gallery as well. But yeah, it was interesting. It was like a super learning experience, and especially to work at the same gallery as an intern 2 years in a row was like a nice little kind of family environment.
So you were picking up all the professional tasks and whatnot really early on.
Yeah, sort of, I mean, even just as much as to, you know, organize or format press releases or, you know, type up CVs. I mean, like, you don't really learn that stuff in school, especially not as a freshman in college.
Sure.
And I'm not sure that I would have paid as much attention to the kind of, like, professionalism of it had I not had that kind of, like, very start at the bottom experience of, like, just tasks.
Right.
But then just, you're just watching how things work. So.
And I guess we should maybe sort of jump to the what sounds like one of the more critical elements of having worked in galleries is what it taught you about artist gallery relations and how to present yourself and those kinds of things, right? So what were some of the things that you learned, but also maybe as you're describing those, maybe you can think of a particular anecdote or, you know, story or something that exemplifies one of those things?
Well, I mean, I definitely learned the most at my last gallery job, and that was at 303 Gallery. I mean, you learn what a gallery kind of should be doing for their artists, what they should be providing, how they cultivate careers. You know, that happened to be a gallery that had worked with artists for you know, some like 20 plus years. And just watching like how they treat their artist, how they prepare and consider the shows, how, what they allowed their artists to do, even come in and have a vision and, you know, really like each, specifically like each artist kind of worked with one person in particular for the most part, as well as the owner. But to watch those kind of interactions were, you know, very educational for me at least. But I mean, I think that you definitely adapt to a certain language that galleries use and like a certain professional language of art handling.
What does that mean?
Can be beneficial when you're doing your own business.
What does that mean? Art handling.
I just think the way that you, it can help you refine how you speak about your own art. Just how you consider more things. Like, I don't know if there's a specific anecdote, but just to watch some of these artists and be behind the scenes and hear what they wanted and how their vision was, you know, prepared and conveyed, whether it was successful or not, was educational. And, you know, would make me go back. I mean, not that I'm anywhere near the career of these people, but, you know, want to consider similar things or consider more things within my own practice that maybe I just hadn't thought of.
Right.
Because I'm not at that level, you know?
So in other words, what you were basically first answering was that it showed you as somebody working for the gallery, you know, how you can help artists. But what you finally got to was that it sort of empowered you as an artist to ask for certain things or if not of other people, of yourself, you know, that you can,
yeah,
that you
that
can
for sure.
Be ambitious in a certain
and
way.
And then, I'm sorry, go on. Sorry,
I was just saying that you can be ambitious in a certain way that you maybe didn't think of beforehand.
Yeah. I mean, it's also, you see why there are certain standards. I don't mean like standards as in like a bar. I mean, like standards of business, like you remember that it's a business.
Right.
And I don't really try or want to bring that into the studio. But then when you're dealing with galleries, you do need to remember that it's your business And I think that having worked at galleries, that helps me when I need to have those kind of difficult conversations.
Right.
That's what I mean as far as like a certain language, that it is professional, that it's not, it can't just be emotional, like your emotions are in the studio, but your dealings are should be professional.
Sure.
And there's reasons why things are done a certain way. And I think that a lot of artists get taken advantage of because they don't know that maybe things shouldn't be this way or they should be a certain way. So having had just like this touchstone was valuable to me.
So you knew how not to be taken advantage of, if, among other things, right? So
yeah, I mean, it still happens. You know, people will always mm-hmm. want to, not everybody, I'm not saying like people are bad. I'm just, there's certain things like if you're signing consignment forms or contracts with a gallery, I at least had the information to know what seemed off. And what was standard and what wasn't.
Can we be a little more specific, just, you know, so we can
flesh things out? Like, mm-hmm. you know, if there's discounts on things, like a, you know, either a 10% or a 20% discretion for sales. And, you know, if galleries want you to pay for shipping or they want you to pay for framing, you know, there's a language
no.
and ways to, like, you know, have a conversation to open that up if you don't think that that's the proper way to be doing it.
Right. Well, let's, there you go. Pay for shipping. I mean, that seems like mm-hmm. a bit of a red flag. I mean, in what circumstances
right.
is it okay, if any?
I don't know. I mean, that's really like a conversation, but to me that if that's a completely closed conversation, then that's a red flag and that's bizarre mm-hmm. and weird. And, but I also know that speaking to some other artists, they're like, I don't know. They're like, that's what they told me. I don't know.
Right. So if you get, let me jump in here. If you get a, if you get a contract, mm-hmm. right, let's say you're not you know, who has had this experience, where are you, mm-hmm. Are you going to find a you to show it to, basically? Is that your first course of action? Because you're probably not going to have the resources to show it to a lawyer, right? So what...
Right.
How do you vet your contract?
I mean, I have friends show me stuff. I would ask... I mean, that's kind of like... Like, I have, like, a group of friends and a community. And, like, you know, I think we, you know, live in New York, so we have that. And hopefully
right.
people are close enough to be able to, like, share that information and just cross check to be like, how does this look to you? Does this make sense?
Right.
And like, you know, if there was more openness and transparency, I think like artists would maybe feel a bit more empowered.
My sense is that you are very well prepared if a gallery is trying to take advantage of you, but you haven't had to face that scenario. That's my sense.
No, I have.
Okay, tell me.
You know, I showed with a gallery. I was super excited. It was years ago, and you know, I didn't have a consignment form with them,
mm-hmm.
and I had to badger for 13 months to get paid.
Mm.
I mean, that was my own fault. Mm-hmm. I would never do that again.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So, you know, it's all like live and learn. I wish I had asked other artists that had worked with this gallery.
Right.
And I didn't do that either. Now
right.
I always do that.
Sure.
You know, I think like the more, open we all are and the more in conversation we all are, it's better. It's just, everybody's more clear and everybody would hopefully then be more honest.
Yeah.
So, you know, but with my friends, you know, if friends are asking me if they have a gallery in New York and they're asking to be shown abroad, you know, my personal recommendation would be to go through their primary New York gallery.
Right.
Just so there's paper trails of everything and everything's looked over and
sure.
everything is thorough. And, you know, when things are abroad and if you can't get your work back, you have your gallery on your side fighting to get your work back.
Right.
it's like just in case of a worst case scenario. It's not, you know, to say that, that galleries are looking to take advantage of artists. It's just, I don't know, when everything is done properly, things work. And right. if your primary gallery, let's say if you're in New York and you have a New York gallery, they should be providing that service for you.
Right.
And that's why they get a commission. And, you know, I guess it's from working at a gallery that I do have a respect for that kind of structure.
So here's the next sort of phase is that you were working at a gallery where you were working at several, mm-hmm. but you were working, you know, in your more advanced stage of working at a gallery, the last time. And mm-hmm. you were also an artist. So, you know, and that's something I've talked to other people about, you know, mm-hmm. you had obviously though had a certain amount of momentum, I gather from having worked, you know, from so young, but at a certain point, maybe it's clear to you at what point, you know, you kind of became aware mm-hmm. that here I am, this artist, you know, working at this gallery and that's how I'm being seen.
Right. Like at what point did I decide to,
or, you know, you can take that whatever direction you want, but you see what I'm getting at.
Right. You know, I had thought that I wanted to work at a gallery like all my life, even though I went to school for art making. And after I graduated and my internships, it was really hard to get a job. And I ended up getting this last job during the recession.
Mm-hmm.
And so the market crashed and, you know, I was happy to have any job.
Right.
And this just seemed like a dream job. And, you know, the more I worked on my art, the less I wanted to work at a gallery.
Right.
I think, you know, I was never quite comfortable identifying myself as like a gallerist. Because I was never in a high enough position, but I also didn't have the confidence to identify myself as an artist. And I think when that kind of grew and became important and my time was spent in the studio every day after work and every weekend, it was just more about not wanting to divide that time. And, you know, I had a boyfriend at the time that he was a full-time artist and he had been a full-time artist for 13 years. And to me, that was like the first person I'd ever met that didn't, you know, subsidize. And I'd come home from work sometimes and just, you know, complain or bitch about whatever, you know, you do at work. And he was like, you know, just quit. And I was like, no, that's crazy. I can't do that. Like I need a job. And just the more I worked in the studio, I started to sell and I started to show a little, and then I applied for a grant and I received a grant that was like a nice sum of money. And for me, it was really just more about, I think the more I identified as an art maker, the less comfortable I was at the gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And because when you're in the studio, like, I just think you need to kind of have a confidence and a bravery every day. And that would be shaken a bit at the gallery.
Right.
And it was really just a choice of taking that risk and kind of just going for it. Like literally, I mean, I was turning 30. I just got the grant. I didn't want to move up in the gallery, or go to a different gallery. It was just clearer and clearer that I didn't want to work at a gallery. So, I took the risk and
wait a second. What was the risk?
To leave the gallery and just make art.
Mm-hmm. And how, and without, so you had
without
the,
a safety net.
Right. Okay. So you had the grant. How long was that mm-hmm. grant going to last you?
It was just a sum of money. So, lasted me like a year.
Okay.
Yeah, it afforded me a year. And, but I also started showing and selling. And, you know, my biggest fear was that being in the gallery, like, and having that desire to not want to work at a gallery and to just make art was kind of, propelling me into the studio, and that maybe without the gallery, I just wouldn't go.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be too scared. It would be too much pressure,
mm-hmm.
or like just a dream. I just, you know, remember talking to my friends, just being like, but what if I don't go to the studio? Like, what if this is a mistake? And they were like, no, you'll go. But on the flip side of that, there was always another gallery job to get.
Right.
So I also think that just letting go of like that fear of losing something that isn't right for you anyway, like that you can always kind of get again.
Yeah.
It's wanting not that, you know, is, you know, like the unknown. So,
seems like it would be really hard having that shift at the gallery and then going to your studio afterwards, especially if you had spent some portion of that day, you know, supporting the artists of the gallery.
Yeah. I mean, I really kept life separate there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people do. There were some really great people that I worked with. But it seems, you know, now that I really only became friendly with them afterwards. And a lot of the other artists that worked there were art handlers. And at least when I worked there, which was 5 or 6 years ago, it was hard to kind of like be at the front desk or be in the back or be like with the girls and really like penetrate like this kind of boys club.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're friends, and it's like a great network of people, but, it just didn't happen while I was there. And then after I quit, it's like this whole world kind of opened up, and I had like the time and the energy to go to openings, and I started meeting other people, and people that worked on the Lower East Side and people that worked at different kinds of galleries. And it was just, it was 100% the right move. Just because I was like uninhibited from feeling like there was something I wanted to do that I wasn't doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it just opened up like in so many different ways.
So part of it was
like really vague.
So part of it working at the gallery, as far as, you know, feeling cut off, you know, or not being able to really connect with people until after you left, was a combination, it sounds like, of being a woman on one hand and on the other,
mm-hmm.
being an artist in a gallery, right? So you weren't a gallerist, you were an artist, so you were inhibited in that way. And then you were a woman in a surrounded by a boys network, essentially?
I mean, it was, you know, at the gallery, you know, a woman owns the gallery, and a lot of the women, it was mostly women that worked there. But they were the gallerists and the directors. The artists that worked there were the art handlers, you know, preparators, archivists, and, you know, they all ate lunch together and they all knew each other. And and they were a really nice group of people. I just was a bit separated from it. I think it's, I mean, I don't know. I don't know that many galleries that have like a group of female art handlers. I know that there's a few do. And I think that's great.
Mm-hmm.
But they, you know, they're definitely artists that are working either mostly part-time, but even if they're full-time, like they're definitely artists that are working at a gallery. Whereas for me, it was just, it was a job I had, and I wanted to do my best at it, but I didn't want to be a gallerist there. And, and you know, but that could have, that's probably on my own fault too, that I lacked the confidence to be like, hey, I'm an artist. Like, can I eat lunch with you guys too? You know?
Yeah.
I'm sure I was, you know, super shy about it.
Yeah, sure. And what about work, having this successful boyfriend who I assume you're going to mention because you don't want to be so coy, right?
No, I'm not going to mention him.
Oh, okay. You are going to be coy. But, got it. So what was that? So what was that like, having that influence?
We're not together anymore.
Oh, I see. You don't want to give him that credit. Okay. That makes sense.
No, it's not credit or not credit. It was just more of it was inspiring to me, but it was also really frustrating. And, you know, in so many ways, it was just this super free, like, freedom that he kind of showed me.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he worked really hard, but, you know, a difference, like, he'd always just make me laugh. Like, I'd come home and, you know, you spend your whole day working. I mean, it could be any job, but you spend your whole day working instead of being in the studio where you want to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, you know, you're just complaining about your day at work, and, you know, somebody got to do what they wanted to do. But to be that free just seemed so impossible at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was just interesting that once, I did decide to leave, the gallery to pursue this, like, I was no longer with him, but I really did want to thank him for kind of showing me that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now I know a lot of artists that are full-time artists or, you know, have some part-time work, but are pursuing it. But then I didn't. That was like 2010 or something.
Mm-hmm.
I learned. I just learned a lot. It was just not what I wanted to do.
Sure,
you know,
sure,
all.
Sure, sure. Okay.
Yeah.
when you were the environment and the community that you were describing a little earlier, you know, with all these friends who are making a living from their work, which is great, obviously. It jives with, I had a very important conversation with Nato Thompson, the curator and writer, in the last episode that I put out. And, you know, one of the things we were talking about is the capitalist or the market part of the art world.
Mm-hmm.
And he described how there are very few people in the art world who are, you know, really, I'm not going to get the exact phrasing he used right, but essentially what he was saying is that there's a very small minority of artists who are sort of have these, you know, successful businesses, you know, so he wasn't necessarily referring to like the big giant studios. It wasn't totally apparent what he was referring to, but he was not characterizing an art world in which there are a lot of artists making a living. And I guess I wonder if the fact that you know so many who do is because you are kind of right in the center of it all, you know, and that's just where a lot of them live, or if it's more a case of, you know, there are a lot more artists who are, you know, doing okay, you know, than some people think.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know very many people that are like just rolling in money right now.
Right.
You know, when I say like successful or living off their art or quote like full-time artists, I mean, I think full-time artists still means that you can have, you know, a part-time job.
Okay. I hate to be pedantic about it, but I guess I kind of want you to sort of flesh out what you would characterize as far as, you know, your artist community, because the perception, which may be a misperception, is that your community, your artist community, includes a large number of artists who are making a living only from their work. That was basically what I was getting.
I do right now. I do as of like the last 2 years.
And everybody else too. That's who I was talking about too.
I mean, I think everybody is struggling at different times. There's a reason why, I mean, a lot of artists are professors, you know, partially because they want to teach, but it's also to subsidize their career.
I mean, that's really pretty obvious. I was basically, you were describing a lot of friends of yours who are making a living from their work. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, it sounds like you know a lot of people who are making a living from their work. That's basically all I'm talking about.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, listen, a lot of people that I know have had a lot of institutional support as well. They are able to do this through residencies,
mm-hmm.
Through not being in New York full-time.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if they're like on the residency kick, kind of bouncing from one to the next. A lot of them receive grants. And yeah, some people are doing really, really well. A lot of people I know, like this last year was the first year where they didn't have a part-time job,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which is amazing.
Mm-hmm, right.
But, you know, I don't think anybody expects that to be a constant. I don't think it's a fear that it's gonna fall out. I just think that, you know, they're gonna continue making their work. As far as the market is concerned, you know, it's very fickle. And you can be, you know, on trend. Hopefully nobody's making their work to be on trend. But you can have a great year, you can have a great few years, and then it could be really, really slow. And for myself and the people that I know that have been making art as their, you know, full income, you know, the money really goes back into the work. It goes into your studio. Maybe you get a bigger studio.
Mm-hmm.
Your supplies get more expensive. Your materials, you know, your cost of materials get more expensive. Your ideas are bigger. And, you know, in that realm, like maybe you move on to a bigger gallery. Yeah, I mean, for the most part, everybody I know is very humble and very, you know, everybody seems to have an understanding that like things don't necessarily maintain that way.
Right.
You know, all anybody can do is just continue to make their work and be their own critic and just want it to be better than the last show they had, and do what they need to do in order to make sure that the work continues to grow, regardless of the market.
Mm-hmm.
And if, you know, if they need to get jobs, then they'll get jobs. You know, I might have to soon, and I will.
Do you have any?
I've had a good run, but you know, I don't know how long that'll last.
Do you have something in mind when you say that? That you will if you have to?
No, I don't have anything in mind. But I'm hoping I can just continue to work in my studio.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. We'll see. I mean, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, I think that's great about the humble. I mean, there's something about that that there's such a paradox in that, you know, that on one hand, mm-hmm. you have to have a lot of confidence to be making the work, mm-hmm. and you have to present, mm-hmm. going back to that, being professional in the way that you interact, you know, with gallerists and whatnot. You have to sort of have that confidence in the way you talk about your work. And yet, you know, the other side of it is being humble in terms of being realistic, not getting letting your ego get inflated, and so on.
Sure, sure. And I think part of that is managing your own career in the sense that, you know, you have a strong sense of your own market, not in a grander market sense, not in a comparative sense to other people that maybe you've shown with, or friends or peers that are, you know, selling for more or selling for less. You kind of have like a sense of self and like what your work is worth, like regardless of a monetary market, and definitely not in a comparative way.
That's an interesting idea. Can you flesh that out a little bit? I mean, what is it? Go ahead.
No, I just think, you know, like keeping your prices at a certain level, or knowing why your prices should be raised, not necessarily because you've sold a lot or not necessarily because, you know, one of the things that, in my opinion, is that, you know, you're hopefully working with professionals and dealers and gallerists that can help guide you. You work together, a team, and you make the best decision. It's a long game, you know, if this is what you want your life to be, it's a long game.
Right.
And it's not about making that quick buck or seeing that, you know, your work's super hot right now because of a certain trend.
Right.
And kind of exploiting that. I mean, that is just to be smart about it. You know, the people that I'm closest to that I have like the most conversations with about this stuff, like everybody seems to be very aware of all of that.
Right.
So, you know, it's a good group that I have because we all talk each other through this stuff and ask each other's opinions. Again, I just feel really fortunate to have that, but I'm not sure that everybody does. But it's completely, you know, precious and very valuable, with my own work.
Sure. But you also mentioned, I feel like you left out the part where, correct me if I misheard you, but I thought at one point you said you recognize the value of your work outside of the market. So in other words, I was hearing kind of sort of this almost abstract sense of value, like, or something along those lines that you attribute to your work.
Well, you know, sometimes maybe you're working with a new gallery or maybe you're working with a gallery that wants to raise your prices. You know, I think to know that things should maybe be that, stay that price or maybe be raised super incrementally instead of being hiked up is important. That's what I meant by knowing your own value, not devaluing yourself.
Oh, I misheard you then.
But
I thought you were talking about something more existential.
No, not like devaluing yourself and you're not worth, you know, more, but certainly not buying into a hype that maybe you can't come back from.
Right. Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. So what's the next trend coming up, Lauren? What's coming down the pipe?
Oh, I don't know what the next trend is. I mean, abstraction was really big for a few years, and now, you know, all these conversations about the figure being back. And to me, like, it's all pretty silly.
Sure.
Because neither of those things ever left. And
you know, Kadar and I had this exact same conversation.
I talk with him about it.
Right.
A lot. And
what kind of things do you talk about,
you know,
other than that?
I mean, what else do we talk about?
No, I'm sorry. I mean, just in addition to what we've already established, what else about, I mean, are you bemoaning the fact, for example, that people are getting all, you know, hyped about figuration or what? What kind of things are you talking about that?
No, I mean, I think it's wonderful. Like if I think it's the same criticism I have about the same, you know, kind of hoopla with like abstraction that happened. Like there's always good art, and sometimes like what's really good and what's okay gets mixed together and put under one big umbrella.
Right.
And that's my critique for both, you know?
Sure.
That's where I think, you know, you make your art without all of that in mind.
Right.
And, you know, you compare you to your work and nothing else. Yeah, don't be, you kind of can't control whether you're placed under that umbrella sometimes, but I think that if you are, it's important for you to be able to articulate what makes your work different. What makes your work yours. And if you don't want to be under that umbrella, like how to change it, how to expand it. And a lot of times the work is more expansive than that conversation.
So is that a conversation you've had to have then, saying, you know, actually my work is not part of what you think it is because of XYZ?
Yeah. I mean, I think really any artist probably has. And it's not in a defense, it's just in a greater understanding of somebody's reasons for making. And maybe that interests the person asking and maybe it doesn't. But, you know, I have some figurative painting friends that will say, you know, I'm not just a figurative painter, I'm a narrative painter.
Mm-hmm.
These are stories. This isn't just a figure. And they want to explain a story. And they need to make that clear, you know, that distinction, because that's why they're making this. But you also need an audience or a person that's interested enough to ask why you're making something. And maybe that's, you know, the job of the artist to make you ask that question. So, you know, I hope people do ask that question.
What question would it be to you?
I feel like for me, so much about my work, is a conversation of process, and I really, with the last body of work I made, really, it was still about that, but really moving beyond that into more of a concept as to why it's these materials and why it's this process,
mm-hmm.
and why it's transformation and why it's so time consuming, and why it's drawing. And the more I can talk about that, the less it's just a conversation about process. And to me, that's more interesting. That's more of a story.
Right.
And it explains, you know, who I am, and it places the work within the studio, and it places the work in context to art history, and it places the work in context to the world and other artists. You know, it contextualizes things. That's a more interesting conversation, mm-hmm. to me at least.
Right. Sure. Yeah, I think context is always up there for me too.
Right. But, you know, you have to want people to be interested enough to ask. So.
Yeah, that can be really tricky.
Yep.
Well, Lauren, this has been intense and interesting. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much. No, this has been a pleasure.
Absolutely. And we're out. Thank you so much again to Lauren for talking to me, to us. And you better believe that when you go back to that section where she talked about your professional interactions, that she has been super professional in her correspondence with me and spot on with the email about working at a gallery and her materials as well. So again, if you haven't already checked out the images of her work and her studios, go to theconversationpod.com to do that. If you would be interested in supporting the show, of course, there are a number of ways you can do that. You can donate to the show via the website, via PayPal. And as I've said before, I love getting those emails saying you have received a donation into the special folder of my
email inbox. Of course, you can follow the show on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram, Twitter, and now Snapchat. And, you know, you can find us on Facebook as well. Become a fan there. We do have some special things to give you now that we've gotten through the business. And that is, first of all, I want to give our Instagram of the week shout out to Matt Jones at mattjonesrules.com. That's at mattjonesrules.com. You can follow Matt Jones through Paris in his painting residency as he prepares for a gallery show. One of our last Instagram shout outs from last week, Mandy said that she got some more followers from her shout outs. So I encourage you, if you are so interested and inclined, get in touch with us if you would like to have a shout out of your own. Before we get to the new feature, Bad Advice, I wanted to just read you a couple of new iTunes reviews in the encouragement that you go to iTunes and write a review and give us 5 stars, please, if you haven't already. The first one is from Alexander Laurentius, who gave 5 stars and wrote, intelligent host who asks great questions without being overly academic, great guest roster. And then Rumpled gave the show 5 stars as well, and he wrote, material of highest quality. Michael's work with the show is a step away from the dysfunction in the art community that I'm sure you're all familiar with. Anyway, the podcast has been more educational and insightful than 99% of my art school experience. Thanks to all parties involved. Wow. Thank you, Rumpel. That's awesome. So if you would like to write a review, it would be very much appreciated because it helps more people find the podcast. You can go to iTunes and look up The Conversation, Unartist Podcast, the original name. All right. Now, some bad advice. Xander Lassen, who is an artist in New Hampshire who has been contributing to this podcast recently, gave me some pieces of bad advice for you. So the first one is, early to bed, early to rise, work like hell, and advertise. That's from Lawrence J. Peter. Then we've got, be that kitten on the branch and hang in there, baby, which is Nicole Eisenman's advice to younger artists. And then we have, get a job as a bouncer in a sex club, from Werner Herzog. Sorry, that was a horrible Werner Herzog accent. Get a job as a bouncer in a sex club, he writes. Okay, that should help. And just a couple more things that Xander gave to me. He recalled that Paper Monument put out an Art World Etiquette Handbook, and one of the tips he remembered was the 10-block rule. Don't criticize the art until you're 10 blocks away. So be careful. I have been burned once or twice sharing my thoughts on something with somebody when I was not far enough away from something or somebody. So be careful about that. And lastly, he suggested maybe we do a little segment on museum etiquette and offer bad advice in that regard. And I love this one. So not pointing at art with your finger, but instead gesturing with the back of your hand. So I give you the back of my hand and say to you, thank you very much for being here. Thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. Do let us know what you think one way or another about this episode, about the programming via the survey or just via an email. And we will be back next week with another exciting episode. Thank you so much. Hope you are having a good end of summer. It is late August now. And have a great Labor Day in store. And I will talk to you next week over Labor Day weekend. Ciao for now.